We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Well, it is Tuesday, September 17th. Today is Constitution Day, by the way. This isn't as heavily celebrated as July 4th and Independence Day, but for all of you who love and appreciate the Constitution and want to see this great country continue in freedom, prosperity, and the blessings of liberty, take a moment and celebrate Constitution Day today. And my good friend Daniel Horowitz tweeted or posted on X, rather, that the federal government has basically violated every piece of the preamble, which is the basis of our social contract. Obviously, I would take issue with social contract. I think, of course, that we are premised on divine law and on the blessings of liberty that come from God, our Creator. It's not just a social contract. But nevertheless, they violated every value within our social compact, and it is therefore incumbent upon the states to fight back. And I agree with that. And hopefully the 10th Amendment will persist. So happy Constitution Day. But we are still continuing to talk about the fallout from the second assassination attempt of former President Trump. And this coming from Time just this morning. Secret Service plans to overhaul after the second Trump shooting attempt. Apparently, it only took two times to get the Secret Service to actually figure out that, you know, maybe this isn't a great idea. So a day after the second armed assassin in 2 months got uncomfortably close to executing former President Donald Trump, this coming from Time, the Secret Service is rethinking its approach to protecting current and former presidents, the head of the agency said Monday. So this is a cut from that from the Secret Service director on a geopolitical event that he thinks, you know, may happen. And this actually got a little bit of speculation, because in the midst of talking about the Secret Service protection, he's kind of forecasting that, you know, maybe something is going to happen in the next 50 days before the election that may change kind of the dynamic here, which was just really, to me, a little bit of an odd statement. But listen to the acting Secret Service director. This is Cut 7.
But the long and short of it is this. Coming out of Butler, I have ordered a paradigm shift. The Secret Service's protective methodologies work, and they are sound. And we saw that yesterday. But the way we are positioned right now in this dynamic threat environment, it has given me guidance to say, you know what? We need to look at what our protective methodology is. We need to get out of a reactive model and get to a readiness model. There could be another geopolitical event that could put the United States into a kinetic conflict or some other issue that may result in additional responsibilities and protectees of the United States Secret Service. And so we are working, we are making information available to all of our partners. And I just want to say that the commitment of Congress to the Secret Service throughout the years has been tremendous. And we will continue to work with them and Secretary Mayorkas, whose support in making sure that we're getting what we need has been phenomenal.
And so according to Time Now, lawmakers are openly asking whether the Secret Service has assigned enough agents to Trump's detail after two failed assassination attempts. So let's welcome in Jeff James, who is a former Secret Service agent. Good morning, Jeff. And what do you think about the state of the Secret Service?
Hey, good morning, Jenna. Thanks for having me on. So I will tell you, from the time that the Secret Service went from being under Treasury to being under the Department of Homeland Security in 2003 until the time I retired, I really thought that the Secret Service should give up all of its investigative responsibilities, with the exception of investigating threats toward people under protection, and purely be the executive protection arm of the Department of Homeland Security. Because if you think about it, it's a little bit ridiculous that we carried that those investigations over with us. So we left Treasury and went to DHS, but we're still chasing counterfeiters. We're still investigating credit card fraud and identity theft. You know, all of that could be given to the FBI or Treasury, back to the Treasury investigators. And we could still keep our cyber people, because there's a cyber piece that falls under the umbrella of protection that's very important. So those agents with that expertise would still have a very robust mission. But I don't know what exactly Acting Director Rowe is talking about when he says a paradigm shift, but it almost wouldn't shock me, and it would make me kind of happy for my old agency if that's what ended up happening.
That's a really interesting perspective. And I think that a lot of people really only know the Secret Service's most well-known mission, which is to protect the president. And, you know, we see that in the movies, obviously, but aren't really aware of some of these other issues that are still going on. And with the under budgeting and understaffing, and clearly the lack of sufficient protective detail on former President Trump and possibly other principals, is there an allocation of resources issue because of these other investigations and other responsibilities that you're talking about? I mean, is that something that, if it's reallocated, in your view, could help the understaffing problem?
Well, protection always came before investigation. So even if you had a big investigation, you were ready to arrest a guy who had $30 million worth of counterfeit sitting in his basement, and you got a call that the president was coming in 3 days to your town, your investigation, as robust as it was, went on the back burner, and you were dedicated to protection. But what it would do, so my point is that people were always pushed toward protection. But what it would do is create a situation where, if we're talking about work-life balance and stress levels and things like that, all those agents could go work on protective assignments and never have to be sitting there thinking in the back of their mind, you know, oh my gosh, I'm sitting here covering this foreign head of state or the president or vice president, and when I get home tonight, I got to write a report about my investigation that I'm doing. So it increases the stress level. It increases the number of hours people were putting in. I will tell you, I had a boss. I was on a foreign trip, and I had a boss one time early in my career who told me he wanted me to work my cases from overseas. So I was working 10 or 12 hours a day on that protective assignment, going back to my hotel room and making calls from overseas to police departments and merchants and everything else, trying to get leads on this counterfeit case I was working. And not only was it almost unfair to me to make me do double duty, but it also ran up like a $300 phone bill in a hotel that the government had to pay for. So, bosses like that were few and far between, I will say, but there is room for improvement if we would just use that laser focus just for the protection assignments.
And I'm speaking with Jeff James, who is a former Secret Service agent. And what initially was the rationale from moving the agency from the Department of Treasury to the Department of Homeland Security? And do you think that actually did improve it?
Well, I will tell you, I'm not too proud to admit I was wrong. So when that announcement came out after September 11th in 2003, we were going to be moving over, I thought, boy, this is great. It's going to be this giant agency. We're going to have a big checkbook. We'll have plenty of manpower and plenty of money. And I got to be honest with you, I was wrong, because what ended up happening is there's 33 different agencies under DHS with only, a pie of money so big that has to get divvied up among all those agencies. So I don't know what the rationale was for moving the Secret Service, but I thought it was going to end up being something better for everyone. And I will tell you, there's a lot of retired folks who all of us communicate in different ways, whether it's social media, via text, who agree that we would have been better off staying under Treasury, and we would be better off if we moved back. And even if we kept the investigations by virtue of moving back, I feel like we'd be better off being that big fish in a small pond rather than trying to swim with 32 other agencies and fight for money.
Yeah, it seems like sometimes the big federal bureaucracy, if there's too many different parts, then a lot of things get lost in the shuffle. So turning to the two assassination attempts of former President Trump, where do you see the failures of the current Secret Service and what should be improved? Because there's a lot of talk about, you know, the Butler failures, but then that they're actually, it was a success at least to identify and see this sniper before he got a shot off. But there are still these questions outstanding of how he even got that close and was able to stake out in the bushes on the sixth hole for allegedly 12 hours.
Yeah, you know, it's tough. And outdoor events, and both of these attempts took place outdoors, they are the hardest thing I did in my career. Sight lines going for thousands of yards, there's buildings, there's foliage, there's, you know, plenty of places for people to hide. So it is a tough assignment. I will say that one of the things maybe that has to happen is, look, you go back 25 years ago, 30 years ago, like my brother was a hunter, so I knew he had a rifle. I knew a couple other people that hunted. They had rifles and shotguns. But not everybody had a rifle. Now you've gotten to the point today where Joe Schmo is going to a sporting goods store and buying a rifle that can put lethal rounds hundreds of yards downrange accurately on people. It is tough to spread out a perimeter that far. Like, you know, I look at what happened at the golf course on this last attempt, and, you know, I don't know that the Secret Service could have shut down that roadway and interrupted commerce and travel and everything else. But, you know, I think what's realizing now, maybe this is the paradigm shift again that Acting Director Breaux was talking about, is our perimeters can't be out to 150 yards anymore, because we know bad guys can shoot from 400 yards. You know, maybe there needs to be this spread moving forward, rather than just saying, hey, we're going to be concerned about handgun range. When I was, you know, my early years and all the way up until my retirement, the term we always used was handgun range. Well, we can't worry about just handgun range anymore because of, like I said, anybody can go to a gun store and have a rifle tomorrow. And that's not only a burden on the Secret Service, that's a burden on all of law enforcement, these high-powered weapons.
Yeah, and that seems to be a lot more difficult of a threat to contain, obviously. And so are you concerned moving forward in the last, you know, 50 days until the election, that former President Trump's life is seriously in jeopardy, because now there have been two attempts that we know of? I mean, there could have even been more than that we're just not even aware of.
Yeah, well, I'm concerned for everybody under Secret Service protection, because we know we surround the bullseye. We, you know, whether it's President Biden, whether it's Vice President Harris, or you know, former President Trump. I think you would be amazed at the threat level for all these people. I know former President Trump is unlike any former president we've ever had. Even before he got his package of protection that he has now as a candidate, he was doing rallies for 20,000, 15,000 people. And we never saw that from a former president. But the threat level is pretty high on all of these people. So I'm actually concerned for everybody. You know, and when you take politics out of the mix, the ability for someone to use violence to affect an election, or just, you know, like we saw in June of 1968, when it was, you know, 3 months before the election, or I'm sorry, 4 months before the election, and Robert Kennedy gets murdered. That created a shift in American history. So I won't say there's the potential for that to happen, but it is absolutely a concern with candidates on both sides.
Yeah, and this is where, you know, the type of rhetoric, I mean, I don't like the whole both sides-ing, because I think that that it's very clear that when President Trump is calling Kamala Harris a communist, he can back that up, because those are her policies. But when they're saying he's a threat to democracy and he's literally Hitler, that only reinforces that, you know, somebody, if he's literally Hitler, then it would make sense to take him out, right? And so, you know, some of this type of rhetoric, the mainstream media, and particularly the leftists, are trying to both sides it. But I do think that the political rhetoric here needs to be focused on the issues, not so much the people, so that they don't try to incentivize or incite some of these otherwise crazy people to go out and try to take shots, because that is not the way that our country works, and that is not the way that our political system works. We should try to beat each other at the ballot box, not in any other way. But Jeff James, really appreciate your insights so much, and thanks so much for your time. Would love to have you on again as the investigation continues. That's Jeff James. He's a former Secret Service agent, and we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. If ending babies' lives in their mother's womb isn't heartbreaking enough, the Biden-Harris administration punishes those who protect life, including up to 10 years in jail. In a shocking stance, the Democrats' vice presidential nominee, Tim Walz, supports infanticide, meaning the death of newborns. When will this madness end? Preborn's network of clinics is positioned in the highest abortion areas in the country, on standby to protect and love mothers facing unplanned pregnancies. By introducing a woman to her baby through ultrasound and showering her with God's love, her baby's chance at life doubles. But they can't do it without our help. If you are pro-life, please consider a donation of any size to support the mission of Preborn. All gifts are tax deductible and will help defend the defenseless. One ultrasound is just $28, or five ultrasounds is $140. $5,000 will sponsor ultrasounds for Preborn's entire network for a full day. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com/AFR, preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we're still talking about the fallout from the second assassination attempt of former President Trump. And of course, with about 50 days to go before the 2024 election, I can't even believe we're this close. It seems like we've been talking about this election ad nauseum for the last, 4 years, really, but especially the last 2 years since Donald Trump announced his candidacy for the GOP nomination. But we're finally this close. But there's still actually a long time to go in terms of protecting Donald Trump. And I would encourage everyone to be praying for the safety of President Trump, the safety of everyone involved in all of this, and also for the safety of the Democrats as well. I mean, there have not been any attempts on the Democrats, and J.D. Vance pointed that out yesterday in terms of saying the rhetoric that doesn't need to calm down from both sides. He said, listen, it's only been Donald Trump that has been shot at twice, and not the left. And I'm not sure that that's really helpful. That's true for sure. And I said yesterday on a media hit where I was a guest that Donald Trump has now been shot at as many times as Kamala Harris has sat for interviews, and that's the state of the election, and that's actually pretty sad. But that takes the focal point off of the issues. And I don't think that the left should get away with that, because Kamala Harris did this interview on ABC. We mentioned this briefly on yesterday's program with my guest Pedro, who actually had a really good point that Kamala Harris is intentionally being vague about her policy positions, about her campaign promises, because she doesn't want to take responsibility for the Biden administration's failures, which she absolutely owns. And she doesn't want to actually say her policy, because she genuinely has socialist, Marxist, communist policy positions. And when you're talking about redistribution of wealth and debt, when you're talking about the Marxist oppressor versus oppressed, and the systemic racism that they think is embedded in our society, when you continue to talk about all of these things that she has substantively talked about during her time in office, then she can't suddenly become this brand new candidate that says, oh, this is a new way forward, and just forget my entire record. I mean, they're actually trying to position her as someone who will provide for criminal justice reform, be tough on crime, but fair on crime. And I mean, I'm old enough to remember when she was running in 2020 and Tulsi Gabbard, who was on the Democrat candidate stage, absolutely took her down by pointing out that she allowed innocent people to stay in prison just to advance her own record as a prosecutor in the state of California. I mean, you know, this is somebody who actually has a record of public service, if we want to call it that, but at least being in public office, that she has to answer for. And I hope that we will get another debate. I don't think that that's entirely likely, especially after how the last one went. I don't really think that either side, for a variety of reasons, really is going to want another debate, other than maybe perhaps getting some better moderators. And ABC's credibility is certainly in the tank on that one. But if we get another debate, what President Trump absolutely needs to highlight is the worldview difference and the policy differences. Because even in the wake of this second assassination attempt, now the left, just like the first one, is going after the whole gun grabbing issue. And Kamala Harris actually said on the debate stage that she and Tim Walz are gun owners, and so no, they're not coming for our guns. And I'm thinking, that is such a lie. You want to allow the people that you want to allow to have guns, to have protection, to have Secret Service with weapons, but for the average American, you're perfectly fine with things like red flag laws and having just a neighbor call and say, you know, that guy kind of looks suspicious, and you know, maybe he's not proud of his lawn, like Kamala Harris's neighbors, you know. And so, and then a judge just say, well, you know, in the interest of just making sure, we're going to deprive you of your God-given constitutionally protected rights, and you have to then earn them back and prove and have the burden of proof to show why you should be able to exercise the right of self-defense by a firearm. I mean, these kinds of substantive issues really matter, and we've gotten virtually none of that from either side. I mean, there are a lot of conservatives and really good conservative commentators, like my friend Steve Dace. I know a lot of you wrote in yesterday saying that you really appreciated his segment. I love having him on as much as he will come on, because he's very substantive while talking also about the biblical worldview of how Christians, not just conservatives, but Christians need to engage in civil government. And the best way that we can engage is to ensure that we are talking about policy that substantively matters, that goes back to the U.S. Constitution. And this is, like I mentioned at the outset, this is Constitution Day. So there is no better day to talk about the ratification of the U.S. Constitution that is grounded and premised in the worldview statement of the Declaration of Independence, that our rights come from God, our Creator, not our government, and the sole purpose of government is to preserve and protect those rights. The biggest difference between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris is how they view the powers of government and what the government can do. I mean, why don't we take, you know, all of the money that's funding the, 86,000 IRS agents? Why don't you give that to Secret Service for protection? Or why don't you give that to the Department of Homeland Security for border enforcement? And better yet, why don't you give that to the states to go and actually enforce their own borders, like the state of Texas? I mean, give that for more buoys. I mean, you know, these are things that actually matter, that we have to go back to the root worldview issue of where both sides are actually coming from. Because it's not just about the top level policy. And of course, policy is derived from that worldview. But you have to first understand the worldview of where each of these candidates are coming from. And today on Constitution Day, if we actually go back and we look at the U.S. Constitution, and I encourage everyone, read it with your family, read it today, read it with your kids, but read it in tandem with the Declaration of Independence, because we unanimously as a country agreed that to recognize the truth, that truth itself is self-evident, that all men are created equal, they're endowed by God, our Creator, with certain unalienable rights, and among those are life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and in order to secure those rights, then governments are instituted among men. And so this is where, as a conservative, I recognize the fact that government is a legitimate institution when it is acting according to the truth and the person of truth, whose name is Jesus Christ. Government, of course, can act illegitimately. And then, of course, we push back on that. We say there are times to exercise civil disobedience, even. There are times to say, no, government, you shouldn't be doing that, especially the states. The states should harness and helm their sovereignty to push back against the federal government. But we as conservatives are not like the capital L libertarians or some of the far right. And I know, you know, a lot of people use that term libertarian and doesn't describe everybody, just like Republican doesn't describe everybody, right? And even Democrat doesn't describe everybody. But I'm talking about, you know, the overarching worldview of that party position. Generally speaking, libertarians think that always less government is better. And government is only there to arbitrate contract disputes, you know, very, very, very minimal. And that actually goes against the legitimacy of government, because government needs to be involved in things like protecting life, protecting your and my right to keep and bear arms and to have self-defense, parental rights, to ensure that we can, as Americans, exercise powers of government that are reserved to us in our churches, in our families. Parental rights is an exercise of power that our form of government specifically reserves to the parent, not to the village or to the state. The children don't belong to the state. And we have to delineate what powers can be exercised by what entities or people. And for the powers that the government does exercise legitimately, we shouldn't want to deprive them of that power, because then ultimately we won't have an upright and well-ordered society. And that end goal, the chief end of government and of our system and of our Constitution, to be a well-ordered society, to preserve and protect the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity, as our preamble to the Constitution perfectly, eloquently dictates, that is what the left overall in their policy are trying to tear down purposefully. They are trying to transform America into a totally different system, rather than protecting natural God-given rights, which include property rights, right of self-defense, you know, all of these things that are God-given. They are trying to foreclose all of those and transform this into this concept called civil rights. And then suddenly civil rights are given by government as privileges, and they can be reinvented and transformed under whatever type of social contract the majority of the leftists prefer. And so this is how we get to the trans agenda. This is how we get to the so-called right of two men or two women to enter into the covenant of marriage, which is an impossibility, actually, because we as human beings don't have the authority, we don't have the power to reinvent what God himself has ordained and established as the institution of marriage. But under a civil rights, quote unquote, type of model for the government, that's what the left is striving for, is to say we are reinventing this so that civil rights under the banner of those rights that are chief according to their worldview and their philosophy, those actually override parental rights, property rights, even freedom of speech, even freedom to believe, you know, which is the only right that the Supreme Court has said is absolute, the right to believe. I mean, you can believe anything you want in this country. I mean, you can believe the wildest conspiracy theory you want. Now, when it comes to acting on that belief, now there are some parameters around that, and the government is legitimate to say, you know, sometimes you can't act on that belief. Like if you're out there actually living a pagan lifestyle and you have a shrine to Baphomet and you want to participate in child sacrifice, the government's going to tell you, no, you can't do that. And that's a legitimate function of government, right? So even if you have that belief, you can't act on it. But this is where the tension has always been throughout American history in particular, but any form of government in any society that is legitimate and is founded on objective morality and has laws that differentiate between what is permissive, what is right, and what is not permitted, prohibited, and is wrong. This tension between my right to believe and act freely versus the right of and the power of government to stop me from acting illegitimately or impermissibly. And that tension has always pervaded. That tension really doesn't exist in a civil rights or sort of framework, because then it's all about this Marxist structure of who has the more oppressed victim status, and their rights then become chief. And even if I disagree with pronouns or you know, the trans day of visibility or whatever, then people like Kamala Harris believe that the government actually has power to forcibly compel me to participate in that worldview and participate in the so-called civil rights that they have provided to these categories of people on their hierarchy and their structure. So it completely reinvents and changes not only the structure of our civil society, but it changes the direction and the goal of what they believe a legitimate government should be and should function as. And this is in 2024. This is the moment that we are at, that we have to ask ourselves as a nation, what do we believe is the purpose and the design of government? Where does government get its legitimacy from? And do we continue to unanimously agree with our founders that our rights come from God, not our government, and to want to persist in this system that provides for the most blessings of freedom and liberty and for ourselves and our posterity that has ever existed on the face of the earth? That is the question facing us in 2024. It's not about the personality politics. It's not whether you, you know, like or hate Kamala Harris or Donald Trump. It's all about the worldview. And if we as Christians and churches especially have to engage with these issues, because it's not just about standing up for one issue. The right to life is very important. I am very hopeful that Amendment 4 in Florida will fail, because it should. I mean, all of those things, yes, we can engage on very important substantive issues, but we have to first and foremost see the worldview issue that is implicit in particular in this election, because it used to be historically that we'd have candidates that both agreed on this generally. They just had different ideas to implement it. And as we have persisted, and as the left has gone completely off the rails into Marxist communism, they have gotten so far off of this that Kamala Harris isn't promising to preserve and protect the U.S. Constitution. The Biden administration hasn't done that. They have failed at every turn. She is promising to transform this country into something that is a leftist utopia, not a constitutional republic that's premised on liberty and rights that are God-given. That is what is at stake in this election. So this is, we can't let the mainstream media just have us focusing on anything else in the next few weeks until the election. And I hope that your churches and your pastors tell them to focus on the worldview. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Hey, if your travels for work or pleasure take you out of town, take AFR with you. You may already know you can listen to the AFR app on your phone, but wait, there's more. If your vehicle is equipped with Apple CarPlay, it can open the AFR app directly. That means you get easier control, and that means it's safer. Safer to use so you can stay informed on what you need to know to keep your family safe. And if you don't already have the AFR app, get it today. It's always free in the App Store. Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, the U.S. Coast Guard is beginning a multi-day hearing on the investigation that has been ongoing for about 15 months about the OceanGate Titan submersible. Remember that story from about 15 months ago? It was last about, I think it was June. With this submersible that was going down to the wreckage of the Titanic, and ultimately it was discovered that it imploded, causing the death of the five occupants on board. And this story, I mean, it was a worldwide phenomenon, because initially it was just reported as lost, and there was this possibility that the Coast Guard could find these five individuals potentially still alive, just trapped on board. And I mean, I remember for an entire week, I was just so wrapped up in this story and learned more about submersibles than I ever thought I would need to know. I didn't even know before this story that there was such a thing as a submersible, but now I know. So this whole public hearing that the U.S. Coast Guard is presenting, just in yesterday's hearing, what the revelation that there were over 100 failures or issues with this particular submersible in the 2 years ahead of this particular venture where it was doomed was just really tragic, and has brought up the larger question about deep sea exploration. So joining me now to discuss is our good friend Ray Alexander, who is a retired U.S. Naval commander. And Ray, overall, what do you think needs to come out of this hearing with the U.S. Coast Guard? And good morning.
Good morning. I'm happy to talk to you again. What I think needs to come out of this investigation by the U.S. Coast Guard is, first and foremost, an explanation, a very detailed explanation of the sequence of events that led to the Titan implosion. And secondarily, and I think equally important, it should analyze the rules, laws, engineering policies and practices, and approval process for classifying submersibles, non-military submarines, basically. That I think is the chain of events that caused the failure. Like you mentioned, the 200 or so failures that led up to the catastrophic event of the Titan imploding.
Yeah, and this to me was just wild to hear. You know, one of the engineers and the workers from OceanGate who ended up quitting and saying, you know, that he was not comfortable with the Titan telling the as he testified yesterday, the former CEO who tragically actually lost his life piloting the Titan submersible. And this gentleman was saying that, you know, he had been asked to pilot it and he said, I'm not getting in that thing. And did he have an obligation and a duty to report this? I mean, where was the any sort of oversight before passengers just got onto this thing thinking, oh, you know, that this has obviously been vetted by somebody?
Well, everybody can understand that he had a moral obligation to report it. And that I think after the fact reporting is, you know, it's helpful in terms of understanding the problem, but not helpful in terms of saving lives. So, yes, I think he had a moral obligation to report, though I think deeper investigation hopefully will reveal holes in the processes and policies that lead up to the certification of the launching of a ship like this, a vessel like this, so that we can catch those, so that there will be policies and practices in place where observations like that from former employees will be hopefully captured. There'll be an avenue to report concerns like that over. Sorry, to over it. It's a habit.
Yeah. Yeah. No worries. Ray Alexander, who is a retired U.S. Naval commander. And, and this is where I was talking in the last segment about how, you know, conservatives actually think that government should get involved in some instances like safety practices, for example. I mean, because this was a commercial operation. I mean, there were paid customers that boarded the Titan submersible. And I think it's the government's responsibility to ensure that that there are safety practices in place, that you can't just, you know, hang out your shingle, like we say in the legal practice, and just say, you know, hey, I can go and represent you in a court of law when maybe I have no idea what I'm doing, or I can take you on this submersible journey where there's really no tests and there aren't a lot of safety mechanisms. And so where are the lines in your view, specifically related to the commercial activity that this company was involved in, where the government should have some regulatory oversight?
It comes in the vessel certification process, and any time a vessel becomes certified, in this case, I believe it's by a commercial, private commercial organization that certifies deep submergence vessels, and so there does need to be some scrutiny. In fact, I think that's probably where most of the scrutiny should lie is in the certification, the vessel certification process. Beyond that, you know, it's difficult to regulate, you know, a very rich man like Richard Stockton Rush III, who has kind of ulterior intentions and ulterior motives that are separate from the safe execution of the mission, that his judgment seemed to be clouded by other interests and distractions. And even in government processes, even in the U.S. Navy nuclear fleet, there's a struggle to continue that kind of dedicated focus on mission. And, even in today's Navy, there are ideological influences that are distracting from that 100% mission focus.
Yeah. And I remember when this story first came out. There were others who are engaged in this type of deep sea exploration, just from a private interest standpoint. You know, not in terms of government bodies or space deep sea exploration. I was thinking of Elon Musk at that moment, and you know, his space exploration. We also have deep sea exploration, but some of the private groups saying that this event set back a lot of that industry and some of the advancements that they had made in terms of the private industry. Do you think now, looking back on this, you know, 15 months later, do you think that has proven accurate, or where are we at in terms of the Coast Guard's hearing?
So I don't think it set back the private industry as far as first feared. I know that there are very wealthy investors that are interested in continuing to explore or expand privately funded exploration projects down into the deep sea. I believe there was a story about an Ohio billionaire who's interested in continuing the funding of such missions down to the Titanic. There's always going to be that urge, that yearning for people to go and explore things or do things that you know, few have ever done. I think those desires should be balanced by a healthy sense of risk mitigation and honesty about your processes and ensuring that you have proper redundancies and safety measures in place. And that kind of gets to your point, your earlier point about, yes, there is a need for, even from a conservative perspective, who, you know, I'm an advocate of small government, and I do not, I see the negative repercussions of overregulation. So that is a fine line. You have to walk that fine line. And I think the outcome of this investigation will help us tailor fit regulations on these industries.
And so what is beyond just talking about the discoveries and the investigation that's gone on for 15 months, is that really the main purpose and end goal of the Coast Guard's hearing at this point, is to see, okay, where were the failures or maybe the holes in regulation, and then they will ultimately issue a report to Congress to legislate on some of this? Or, you know, what can some of the possible outcomes of the hearing be?
I think the Coast Guard's, the primary motivation of the Coast Guard's investigation is root cause corrective action analysis, and then probably also emergency response improvement. So in this case, how, you know, what lessons can we learn from the way that the Coast Guard and the larger combined joint force responded to the emergency? But then the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, has a parallel investigation. And I think that's more of the regulatory questions that are going to be asked, and the standards question, industry standards type questions. Both will be submitted to Congress, and both will be reviewed for implementation into law.
Yeah,
or the Coast Guard will be integrated into practice and process procedure for the Coast Guard and Joint Forces.
And that makes sense. And I'm speaking with Ray Alexander, who is a retired U.S. Naval commander. And, you know, things like this are should be nonpartisan. You know, I mean, we tend to, in the media and especially the news, they focus on the things that are, you know, very Republican versus Democrat and the clash and the contrast. But, you know, some of these things, just like safety implementations and this type of regulation, really shouldn't be partisan. Do you see a lot of that that happens anyway, or is this something that actually is one of those things that Congress can maybe actually work together on? Or do you see this being political?
It's hard to predict the ways that things can will or won't be politicized. And I think that we're probably best off assuming that it's going to become politicized in today's day and age. It's unfortunate, though, because I think that I think this could be an issue where there could be some partisan, nonpartisan forward progress. I think big picture, what causes people to kind of fall on political lines is more personality based, where, you know, risk averse folks tend to be more regulatory, highly integrated government controls on issues, whereas people who recognize sort of the basic instincts of man and our basic human failures, but also enjoy sort of our basic human kind of inclination toward adventure, will tend toward trying to find the right balance between regulation and exploration. And the positive benefits that come from that type of exploration are advancements like what we're seeing with Elon Musk.
Yeah, and I think that's a really great way to put it, that there is a balance. And, you know, some people tend to be more risk averse and in certain situations, and then some tend to say, well, you know, there's always a risk inherent to everything, but I'm going to, you know, mitigate that maybe as much as I feel comfortable with, and then, you know, take the risk and go on the adventure. And if we didn't have those type of explorers, then, you know, we wouldn't know as much about our natural world as we do. And I'm grateful to people who want to be those type of adventurers. But in the context of something like the Titan, where it's commercial, and you have people, you know, obviously somebody who would be willing to do that type of deep sea adventure would have to be a little bit adventurous by nature, I guess. I mean, I'm not somebody that I don't think I would ever get in a submersible and go down to the Titanic. I'm perfectly happy to just see the pictures in National Geographic. You know, that's just me though, right? And other people do want to have those types of experiences. So what should people be looking for, you know, while we're waiting maybe on the regulatory government to catch up a little bit, for the people who boarded this thinking that this had gone through enough of the safety precautions and all of that, that they were willing to get on board, I don't think that the passengers could have possibly appreciated the actual risk that was present in that, because I would have assumed, if this is a commercial venture, that somebody like that company would have taken certain safety precautions that we're now seeing just were not present. So, I mean, to me, that's a total failure. But what should people who are looking for this type of adventure check out with the company or maybe the experience before they partake in that adventure, so that they can do maybe a little bit more of the risk mitigation?
Yeah, it's a great point, Jenna, because we were talking about basically exploration, human exploration, and essentially in most cases, explorers bear the direct and immediate risk of their own decision making. In this case, it was pitched as a tourist sort of exploration trip, and more like a tourist trip down to the Titanic. And there's a qualitative difference between those two. To your question, what should people look for? They should look for a track record. For this specific vessel that they're going down, they should demand evidence that this vessel is reliable under the same circumstances that it'll be put under, during your trip. In this case, I know it had done a few test dives, but I don't believe they were as deep as the Titanic. And if they were, one or two data points is not enough to demonstrate safe history of operation. And there's a lot of other things that might lend somebody to be suspicious. This being the first opportunity to go down to the Titanic on a commercial tourist trip would give me, you know, significant pause. A lot of people aren't savvy enough to dig down into the engineering history or the design of the vessel, but some third party verification that this thing meets certain safety standards, marine safety standards, engineering safety standards, testing standards, would be all what I would recommend they demand. I'm sure they signed a release, a waiver, and you know, you have the right to demand that history of certification, engineering validation or verification, safety verification before you sign any document like that.
Yeah, and I think the lesson here is do your research before you let your adventurous nature get the best of you. And so, Ray Alexander, always appreciate it, and your insights into, you know, this whole world of deep sea exploration and the regulation around it is to me just fascinating, and I always really appreciate your insights. You can follow Ray Alexander, who posts a lot of really great things, in my opinion, on X. You can follow him at RMA1776 on X. And that is all the time that we have for today on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Make Constitution Day a focus of your day today. Read the document and continue to strive toward a moral and upright society, and pray for the future of our nation. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna@AFR.net. We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn.
Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.